True Crime Brewery contains disturbing content related to real-life crimes. Medical information is opinion based on facts of a crime and should not be interpreted as medical advice or treatment. Listener discretion is advised.
I conduct an interview with her. I didn't have to proffer much. A lot of times detectives want to interject questions. This is what I know happened. This is what happened. This is what happened. Sometimes it's just better to let them roll. And, well, that's all we had to do is let Marshall roll.
Why did he come up to the cabin, you know?
I don't know. I have no idea. I just wanted him to shut up. You know, just to f***ing shut up. And so I went back into the house because I just didn't want to hear him. I just was really pissed off. I went into the bathroom, and I had one of his guns there. Shot him in the back of the head. All of a sudden, I see his hand go up, and there was blood just squirting out. I mean, squirting out. And I was like, oh my God, what did I do? You know, so I think it hit an artery or something. And he just like went, oh, and then he dropped it. And then I just kind of like went, oh my God. I cut his head off. I was so mad at him. I was so mad at him. And I cut his head off, and then I cut both of his hands off with chainsaw, and then I cut both of his feet off. But when I cut his head off, I didn't realize how heavy a head is. Mm-hmm. It's really heavy. Mm-hmm. I just watched it roll down his mouth. It was like, oh my God, I can't even believe this. But I have that memory of, you know, watching his head roll down, and I was really mad, and I was screaming at him. You know, for being, you know, for making me do that. For making me do that.
Welcome to True Crime Brewery. I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick.
High on the mountains of Southern California, an overgrown driveway leads to the burned-out piece of ground that once supported Jack Irwin's Mount Baldy cabin. Life has moved on, as it always does, and the forest has grown over much of this site where horrific murder took place. Back in 1999, Jack Irwin sold his cabin for $48,000 to two women, Marcia Johnson and Judy Gellert. He gave them very generous terms, holding the mortgage in exchange for monthly payments of $582 for 10 years.
Yeah, you know, I'm just thinking, those aren't that generous. I mean, it sounds generous, but you're looking at $70,000 for the total cost, and the building was sold for $48,000. So he's making a significant amount of interest. But you're right, it's pretty generous.
But he's holding the mortgage for them because they're a bad credit risk.
He is. He's doing them a favor.
And he also threw in some appliances.
Yeah, so that's generous of him.
Yeah. But by that summer, Judy and Marcia moved in with Jack in his four-bedroom house down the mountain. They explained to others in town that they decided to move in to help him keep house, cook his meals, and make sure he ate well and took his medicine. When Marcia Johnson reported Jack Irwin missing a few months later, she said that she had dropped him off at a train station so he could take a trip to Seattle to see the Space Needle. Marcia had only known Jack for 7 months, but she claimed that she was like a daughter to him. When Marcia and Judy told neighbors that Jack had taken a trip, many were suspicious. Jack wasn't a complete recluse, but he definitely was a homebody. He had never mentioned taking a trip to anyone else. Then suddenly, the women were driving new cars and spending a lot of money. Further investigation would reveal that the women had drained Jack's bank account. In the summer of 2000, the cabin was robbed, then shortly after it burned to the ground. Judy and Marcia collected large sums of money from State Farm Insurance. Then they left town. Jack Irwin's missing persons case became a murder investigation. The murder of Jack Irwin, known as a beheading on Mount Baldy, is our quiet end discussion today. Because Jack was a veteran and a kind-hearted man with a disability, this is one of the most heinous cases of elder abuse on record in California. The lack of remorse demonstrated by his admitted killer, along with the fact that her accomplice has gone essentially unpunished, adds to the really outrageous nature of this case that we're covering today. And Dick has a California beer.
I do. I hope this isn't too redundant, but I'm doing a beer called Chocolate Rain from the brewery, which is in Placentia, California. It's kind of in the correct area, Southern Cal.
Now, why would it be redundant? You've done it before?
Well, I've done Black Tuesday before, same brewery. And this is Chocolate Rain, the beer I'm doing today, is basically Black Tuesday with vanilla beans and cocoa nibs added to it. So it's kind of the same beer, but I wanted to just follow up with them. And then I'll probably branch out for some other beers the next time we do California cases.
Well, I hope so, because people do like you to represent various breweries around the state, not just focus on the ones that you've already had and like. You got to branch out a bit.
I know. I really like these guys.
Okay.
Anyway, Chocolate Rain is a double stout or an imperial stout. It's a dark brown beer with a thin khaki head. Aroma is all booze, dark fruit, with maybe a hint of chocolate and vanilla. Taste is bourbon, some raisins, vanilla, all with a chocolate undertone. So the vanilla bean and cocoa nibs come through more in the taste than the aroma. Pretty thick beer, almost a chewy beer, but it's a good beer.
Okay.
And it's one of those sipper beers because it's a 19% alcohol by volume. So we're going to share this with some other denizens at the quiet end.
Kind of like a licorice syrup.
Right.
Okay. All right.
But
let's open it.
It's a wonderful beer.
Let's open it up and we'll see. I can be the judge of that.
Okay.
All right. Quiet end today. Any opinions on it?
Well, it is pretty quiet, although later on today there's going to be some people in here watching golf.
Oh, that's a rowdy crowd, those golfers.
I know, those golfer people are just like Hell's Angels.
Yeah, God.
So we have to watch out for them. But there's a growing sense of excitement because Tiger Woods is in contention, and everyone loves Tiger.
I don't think that's true at
except
all.
Except for his ex-wife and your mother.
I think a lot of us are not big Tiger fans, but it's always good. Everybody loves a comeback, I think.
That's for sure.
Yeah.
And he looks like he's coming back.
All right. All right. Well, I don't want you to cry about it. So
I won't.
Let's move
on. Don't worry.
Okay.
All right. So Jack Irwin was born in 1928 in Oklahoma, and he loved to race everything, bikes, boats, cars, whatever. He wanted to go fast. But he didn't have much going otherwise, and when he was 22, he enlisted in the Army, ended up fighting in the Korean War. Now, he got seriously wounded by a hand grenade, where he went back and tried to rescue his fellow men, but he couldn't. And this would haunt him through the rest of his life, that he was unable to rescue these guys. But he was seriously injured with his hand grenade, and he woke up in a hospital in Japan, got transferred to Hawaii, then on to San Francisco. And at San Francisco, he learned that he was out of the Army for good because of the damages that he suffered from the grenade.
Well, and this was kind of a blow to him, from what I understand, because he planned on a career in the Army.
It sounded like he wanted an Army career.
Yes. His heroism earned him a Bronze Star, but he also suffered a brain injury that caused spasms in his hands, his feet, and his vocal cords. His neurological condition is called dystonia, and he had difficulty walking. He had a marked speech impediment. Because of this, he was hard to understand, and he didn't socialize much. He was a private person. Strangers had a hard time understanding what he was saying. So he did suffer with a lot of depression and loneliness through the years.
That he did. And I'll just throw in that this dystonia, as you mentioned, is a neurologic condition that results in spontaneous contractions of muscles. So it can affect different body parts, speech included.
But which seemed to be a big one with him.
Yeah, but it caused him to be walking with a limp. He would wear out the side of a shoe instead of the bottom of a shoe. And it's a tough condition. It can be something that's genetic, it's inherited, or it can be caused by other things like infections or drugs. A lot of the old-time antipsychotics could do this. I remember back in my early days as a pediatrician, I had a kid that was on haloperidol, which is one of the early antipsychotics, and he had dystonia from that.
Well, that's really sad.
Yeah, because he was a young, fairly young kid, early teens. But it's not a great condition.
But in Jack's case, it was from an injury in the war.
Most likely.
Well, also after the war, he'd fallen out of touch with his family. And then he never married and never had any kids of his own or established a career afterwards. So he basically lived on his disability checks and retreated into the woods, living in his cabin alone for years and years.
He did. Now, he wasn't a complete hermit.
No.
But he didn't like people except in small doses. So he had lived contentedly in his small cabin on Mount Baldy in Southern California, which was just about an hour's drive from Los Angeles. It's a place where people would go up to hike, canoe, raft, things like that, ski in the winter. So it's a nice area, but very much on the rustic side.
But I bet some city people came there to rough it.
Oh, yeah. So. City people in hours from L.A.?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But it was pretty rustic.
Yeah, it was still the type of place where the doors were kept unlocked and neighbors looked out for each other. They knew each other.
That's right. And Jack was one of those people. He never lacked for things to do, whether it was keeping his cabin neat and tidy, or working on his car, his Subaru, or just sitting in his living room and reading. So we're getting the picture that Jack's a pretty private individual.
Yeah.
Who has simple wants and needs.
But a smart enough guy, an avid reader.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And he was quite comfortable financially.
He was. He had invested in some real estate, and he had over $200,000 in his savings account.
Because he really didn't spend much.
He spent squat.
He was super frugal. I mean, he never came close to spending his $700 a month in disability. In fact, if you looked at his monthly living expenses, it only amounted to about $150 to $200 a month, if you can believe that.
Yeah, well, they broke down his expenses. The rental for his cabin, because it was on National Forest land or something, was dirt cheap. He ate shit, peanut butter.
Well, I don't know if I'd call it shit.
Crackers, noodles.
Basically. I mean, he ate basics.
Very basically, but he wasn't out buying steaks all the time.
No, not a lot of fresh fruit and vegetables either.
No.
It wasn't the healthiest diet.
No. So, yeah, I mean, he was a frugal person who had a good amount of money stored up and never came close to spending his disability check.
No, not at all.
So the money kept accumulating.
Now, a neighbor of his, Sandy Bailey, predated Jack in the Mount Baldy area by about 10 years. Because she worked in the post office, she knew everybody in town. She and her husband took a special interest in Jack. They were lending him movies to watch on his old VCR, inviting him over for dinners. Jack would typically spend Thanksgiving and Christmas with the Baileys, too. Now, in turn, Jack would help out with the chores at the Bailey house. He also loved their kids and doted on their son. Jack loved the boy so much, actually, that the Baileys asked him to be the child's godfather. So they were like family.
They were. They were probably the closest people to him. Now, in the winter of 1998-1999, after living in his cabin for almost 20 years, Jack announced he had gotten too cold. Like an epiphany.
Yes.
So he got in his car, drove 10 miles down the mountain to a town called Upland. And in Upland, for $160,000, which he paid in cash, he purchased a four-bedroom, two-story house on a quiet little cul-de-sac. And he told Sandy Bailey he wanted a two-story house so he could see the mountains. Not too long after that, he sold his cabin for $48,000 to Marcia Johnson and Judy Gellert. And this is what started Jack Irwin on the path to his death.
Yeah, Marcia Johnson was, to put it simply, mentally ill. Over time, she'd been found to be suffering from poor insight, impaired judgment, auditory hallucinations, and bipolar disorder. Her childhood was one catastrophe after another. She had a nervous breakdown at age 10. That's super young. She was molested by a next-door neighbor at age 13. And there were violent beatings by her father and then later by a boyfriend. She actually dropped out of school in the 8th grade. She was drinking alcohol heavily, did drugs, and became sexually promiscuous. So the 8th grade, you're 12 years old?
13 or 14.
So she's very young to drop out of school and to be having sex and drinking.
Yes.
And doing drugs. And then by her late teens, she'd already decided that men were just gross. And she started identifying herself as a lesbian. Then over the next 15 years, she made several attempts at suicide. The majority of these attempts were considered by the mental health specialists caring for her to be gestures. Still, Marcia was resistant to therapy and didn't want to be on medications, so she was definitely a young woman at risk.
Yeah, and the stuff we read, she had a lot of contact with mental health professionals.
Yeah, so at this point, I'm feeling sorry for her.
Yeah.
Sure.
Now, in 1985, just before she turned 25, and after two, perhaps not entirely sincere attempts to kill herself, she ended up at the San Diego Mental Health Services Clinic. Nurse reported on her intake report. She and a friend got drunk, decided they were overstressed, and should drive off a cliff together. So they were contemplating the advisability of this. They got arrested, fortunately, or maybe.
So was this based on Thelma and Louise, or was this before Thelma and Louise came out? I wonder.
85?
This was before Thelma and Louise, I think.
I think it was a little before.
I think Thelma and Louise was time, in the 90s.
Around that time. So she found out that jail, though, was no fun, and she tried to hang herself with a shoelace. And after that, police took her to a psychiatric care facility where she came across as a giggling, extroverted white female who seemed to think this was all a lark.
Well, that's what one of the doctors had written.
Right.
Right. But, you know, she did have this inappropriate giggling thing going on. It's hard to say if it meant she didn't care or what it meant exactly, because she would giggle inappropriately.
She would. And she was incapable, I think, of telling the truth.
A lot of the time, yeah, she was quite a liar.
Very.
Now, in March of 1990, Marcia ended up in another psychiatric facility after she tried to kill herself again, this time with a knife. A month later, she was back again, complaining, with what seems like pretty rare insight, that her lover had left her because she was crazy. Which, gosh, that was probably quite true.
It was, as you said, very insightful.
Yes. So, in contrast to Marcia, her lover, Judy Gellert, was a far more stable person. She had grown up on a farm in Indiana, majored in physical education at Ball State University, and she had gotten married. Her marriage ended in divorce 7 years later, and Judy became dependent on alcohol, marijuana, and eventually methamphetamine. When she got clean, Judy volunteered to work at Stepping Stone, a drug treatment facility up in San Diego. She was eventually hired by Stepping Stone as a counselor, and it was there in the late 1980s that she met Marcia Johnson.
So here we go.
That's where it all started between these two. During the next 10 years as a couple, Marcia and Judy fought often and quite openly. Marcia was 7 years younger, and one of her complaints was that after Judy went through menopause, she no longer was interested in sex. Which is kind of odd, because I don't think Judy was that old to have gone through menopause, maybe? I mean, how old were they when all this happened? In their 30s? So she was maybe in her early 40s?
Maybe early 30s and late 30s, or early mid-30s, early 40s. So not that old.
That would be kind of an early menopause.
Yeah.
But money with these two was one of the big issues, right? I mean, that was a huge problem that led to a lot of things.
No question.
Yeah.
They never had money. They spent it quicker than they earned it.
Well, that's the thing. When they had it, they were so irresponsible, especially Marcia.
I don't know that I ever got a good idea of what Marcia did for a living.
Well, I don't think she worked much.
I mean, I know Judy was a counselor, and she's the one that had kind of a steady job. But I don't think Marcia did much work.
No, I don't think so either. Well, they both declared bankruptcy in late 1998. To save money, the couple had been living in a Gulfstream motorhome and moving the RV from park to park. They were staying in a park near Mount Baldy during the winter of 1998-1999 when they saw an advertisement for the cleanest, cutest cabin you ever saw.
And that was Jack's.
Yes. So he was selling it.
He was, because he had moved down mountain to a house.
Right.
So even though the women had purchased Jack's cabin, they started spending more and more time with him in his new home in Upland.
Yeah, no one's sure why.
No. And there are definite differences of opinion as to how well that was working out. Now, Marcia, on the one hand, said that they became really close friends. Jack was very lonely. Nobody really understood him. But I was really compassionate with him. I got really close. She said that she and Judy even took him to a gay pride parade in San Diego. He had a blast. We were a new lease on life for him, and he thought it was so cool that we were gay.
Okay, I'm not sure. That's kind of weird, isn't it?
That's her side of the story.
Right. Why would he think it's so cool? I mean, whether they're gay or not. I don't understand why that would matter to him. I mean, it might be something different as he's an older guy.
Right.
Maybe the parade was cool. But that's just all what Marcia said.
That's all she said.
So we don't know. Right. Sandy Bailey, the neighbor, on the other hand, said that Jack complained to her constantly about these two women. He said to her, "They're starting to move in and all of my things are gone." So Sandy told him she was really worried about these two ladies moving in with him. She had a very uncomfortable feeling. She would tell reporters later that she really couldn't put her finger on it, but she knew that something was amiss in this situation. She wasn't comfortable with it, and she wasn't the only one.
No, he had his new neighbor in Upland, Susan Hegemeyer, also had some misgivings about these two women. When Jack first moved in, she found him to be funny and friendly, but this began to change when the women moved in with Jack, and Susan was getting increasingly nervous about him and the two women. For their part, perhaps because of the sense of strangeness that two openly gay women want to live with a disabled old man, Johnson and Gellert said they had become so fond of Jack that they moved in with him to keep house, prepare his meals, and make sure he took his medications. Now, there's absolutely no evidence that he was incapable of that.
No.
I mean, he'd lived for 20 years up the mountain, and while being kind of reclusive, had managed quite well.
Yeah, no, he was an older guy. He was 71, and he had dystonia, but other than that, he was quite healthy. There were no indications that he needed help caring for himself.
Right.
Although I could see that maybe he would be lonely.
Yeah, but that's a good story that the two women came up with to say, you know, we're basically taking care of him. That's why we're living here.
Yes. Well, another weird thing was that after moving to Upland, Jack began spending money. And this was a new foreign trait for him.
Yeah, you had mentioned that he was maybe not a tightwad, but he was frugal.
Super frugal. He just didn't buy things, right?
Right.
So he quickly bought a new stove, dishwasher. He got a satellite dish and a new color TV. He also redecorated his living room. And the primary feature was this large painting of two naked women shown from the rear, exchanging adoring glances. So do we see a little influence here from Marcia and Judy?
Well, I'm thinking that Jack probably didn't pick that out himself.
No, probably not. Although some men do like the whole lesbian thing. But he had never shown any interest in decorating his home that way before.
I think the man fantasy about lesbians is watching them making out and making love with each other.
Right. So walking naked and giving adoring looks could be a prequel to that.
Okay.
But Jack became less accessible to the people who had been part of his life. That was the main thing. He'd changed.
He had. Definitely had changed.
Yeah, and it was difficult to speak with him without the girls, as he called them, hovering around him. And they even began calling him Dad, which was a little bizarre.
More than a little.
I mean, it's only been a few months.
Right.
Yeah.
I wouldn't think they'd be that familiar with him that soon.
No, it's very pushy. And so you can really see that money was probably a motivator here.
I think you can see that.
Yeah.
Right?
I can, sure.
In August of 1999, Susan went out to pick up her mail one day, and Jack called her over to him. He wanted to know what she thought. He'd had put all his assets in a trust and then put both girls' names on it. Now, Susan thought this was an absolutely crazy idea.
Well, it is crazy.
It is. Well, again, like you said, they don't know each other for that length of time.
So does it make you think that he was more naive than we thought? Or did he feel threatened? Why was he doing this?
I think he was coerced into it.
Yeah, but for what reason would he go along with it? Out of fear?
Maybe fear, but I think it was presented to him that, you know, we'll take good care of you, make sure that everything works out for you.
Okay. Pretty crazy, though. I'm with Susan here.
Yeah. But Jack said, you know, we're family now. If I die, they get everything I have. And if they die, I get everything they have. Susan was pretty prescient about this. She said, but Jack, they don't have anything.
Right.
Big deal.
These are two younger women, so it's not likely that they're going to die before he does.
Unlikely.
Right. And they don't have anything. That's the big point.
They got squat.
Right. They have debt.
Right. Now, Jack had previously listed the postmaster or post office worker, Sandy Bailey, on his accounts. But by September of 99, Johnson and Gellert had been added to his trust, retirement account, and savings account, replacing Bailey. Also around this time, Sandy called Jack to invite him to her house for Thanksgiving dinner. because that was the norm. Thanksgiving and Christmas, he spent with them. She left a message on the answering machine, but he never called back.
Which was very odd. So the next time Marcia and Judy went into the post office, Sandy asked them about Jack. They said that Jack had traveled to Seattle to see the Space Needle. Sandy immediately thought this was a lie, and she went ahead and put up a missing poster of Jack in the front of the post office. Now this, as you can imagine, caused some friction between her and Marcia, who thought that the community was blaming her and Judy for Jack's disappearance. While Sandy Bailey recalled specific conversations that she had with Marcia Johnson, Marcia would maintain she never once had any conversations with Sandy Bailey. Marcia also said it was her idea to file a missing person report, since it would look better if I did. Now, I could read a lot into that comment. What do you think?
Yeah, no kidding. So she's going to be getting ahead of the stuff.
Well, she's already thinking about how things will look, so she knows that she's done something wrong, essentially,
exactly.
In my mind.
Yeah.
So about this same time, Susan Hegemeyer realized that she hadn't seen Jack for a long time either. So the next time she saw Marcia, she asked her where Jack was, and she got a similar story to the one that had been given to Sandy Bailey. And this made absolutely no sense to Susan. Now, Susan knew that he had signed over all of his assets for the girls to get, and she knew that Jack was not going to be going off to Seattle.
Yeah, I mean, even though she hadn't known him for that long, she knew what the kind of person he was. And this is not a guy who's just going to say suddenly, I think I'll go up to Seattle and see the Space Needle.
No, he's not.
No, not even by any stretch, by himself.
Right, so she was the one who encouraged Marcia to file a missing persons report. And that's when Marcia finally did file the report.
So here we've got the report, Jack is missing, and very quickly the spending started.
Yeah, started full throttle.
It sure did. According to court papers, Marcia withdrew $4,000 from Jack Irwin's account on September 13th, 1999. That same day she bought new tires for her car, and then 2 days later she wrote checks to herself for $7,000 and $10,000 and bought a Corvette and a Jeep.
So she's not being subtle.
Not in the least. Not with a Corvette. A Jeep in that area, sure. But a Corvette?
Yeah.
Not exactly a car to be driving up and down the mountain with.
No.
But the biggest thing was in November when she bought a luxury motorhome for $170,000.
Yeah, that's a lot of money.
I mean, that sticks out like a sore thumb.
Well, for someone who had bought a $48,000 cabin to live in, to go ahead and buy a motorhome that's almost $200,000.
Right.
Plus, does she even have a job? I'm not even sure. I don't think so.
No.
And then her partner, Judy, was a drug counselor, which is, you know, a great profession to do for the world, but it's not a high-paying profession.
It's not a lucrative profession.
Not at all, no. But there was this missing persons report, but Jack is an adult, so there's no law against him just walking away from everything.
Nope, there isn't.
The detective, Steve Folks, investigated Jack's disappearance, but for some reason he concluded nothing was wrong. Why do you think he did that?
Well, like you said, he's an adult, and there wasn't any evidence of foul play. It's just a statement that he decided he wanted to go to Seattle.
Yeah, but wouldn't you look into if he used any money, if there's a plane ticket, if there's train tickets? There's so many things that could have been checked. So
right.
I really think that he dropped the ball there.
Well, I think eventually he did do that. But early on, I can kind of see, you know, you're talking about an adult person. He can do what he wants.
This is a guy that never traveled. These women move into his house and they're spending tens of thousands of dollars, over $200,000 within like a couple months of him going. So I feel like he didn't look closely enough or he would have seen how suspicious it was right away.
Well, I would not disagree with you there.
And Sandy Bailey, and she said that she kept calling and calling to get them to do anything. So.
And finally that came to fruition, but it took a while.
Yeah, and if it wasn't for her, it might never have happened.
Might not have.
Marcia and Judy kept both Jack's cabin and his house in Upland.
Yeah, so now they've got two residences.
And a motorhome,
and a Corvette,
and a Jeep.
Yep.
And they don't make any money. And they had no savings to start with.
Exactly.
And Jack, nobody knows where he is.
But nobody's looking at it at that point.
Well, people who knew Jack are.
And yeah, but I mean, it's always easy in retrospect to say, oh, geez, something's amiss here.
I don't know if you need to be in retrospect here, though. To me, it's pretty clear.
Well, I'll give him the benefit, at least at the beginning.
I think Sandy and Susan were totally on to something here.
Well, we know that.
In June of 2000, they went on a trip to San Diego, Judy and Marcia, that is. And when they returned, they reported that someone had broke into the cabin while they were gone. They alleged that someone had gotten in by way of the doggy door and taken a camcorder, a DVD player, some gold earrings, a laptop, a printer, a CD writer, and a camera. So this crime was never solved, which most break-ins aren't. The police don't have time to really. They just take a report, basically.
Right.
And then Judy Gellert's insurance company went ahead and just paid them $9,000 to cover these losses, which is a pretty high payout for a little cabin having all this stuff in there.
It is. And I mean, we tried to find out how that all worked. But, I mean, here's a $50,000 cabin, and there's $9,000 in stuff that was stolen. I don't know. So in August of 2000, the women moved to a RV park that was nearby in response to what they said was continuing hostility from the Mount Baldy community because they're lesbian.
Yeah, I don't think it had anything to do with that for the most
part.
Well,
of course it didn't.
I think it was because they were taking Jack's stuff and he was missing.
Right. Too much talk about that.
Yeah.
But anyway, on August 11th, there was a major fire in the cabin. When the two women arrived at the scene, the fire department was cleaning up after the blaze. When she heard that the investigator was considering arson, Marcia immediately blamed the neighbors, saying that they didn't like the couple because they were lesbians. So that's a reason. Let's set fire to the house.
Well, I mean, there are hate crimes in history, so that's not totally unbelievable.
Well, except that there was no prior record of any
harassment
or anything.
That's true. She was quick to jump to that as an excuse.
She certainly was.
Like, people are picking on us because we're lesbians.
The neighbors, in turn, told the arson investigator that they had seen Marcia Johnson's Corvette racing down the road from the cabin just minutes after the fire started.
Oops.
Oh, geez.
That's a little funny.
Yeah, but at the same time, Marcia said it couldn't have been her because she was in Upland then purchasing new tires. She buys a lot of tires, doesn't she?
Yeah, she does. But she buys a lot of vehicles.
Yeah.
And they need new tires. Now, despite this fire and its suspicious origins, Judy Gellert's insurance company went ahead and paid her claim again, sending the women a check for $170,000. Wow. Now, they were buying that cabin for under $50,000. Why did they get $170,000 when the place burned down? Was it even worth that? I don't think so.
I don't think so either.
No. The women had then turned around and sold the house in Upland, and they moved to Alpine, California, which is about 3 hours south of Mount Baldy. So, let's look at this. It's estimated that between Jack Irwin's bank account, the sale of his house and his car, the two insurance settlements, these women had acquired about $450,000 in this whole thing.
Yeah, a tidy sum, huh?
Yeah. Yeah. And so, through this whole thing, Judy Gellert is going to say she was oblivious that anything was amiss, right?
Right. I had no idea Marcia was doing that stuff.
Right.
Give me a break.
Fuck her, I say.
Yeah.
Fuck her and the motorhome she rode in on.
Oh, that's good.
So a year goes by. The missing person case on Jack Irwin was getting colder and colder. The initial investigator, Steve Folks, had actually run out of people to interview. At this time, because of Sandy Bailey's persistence, Detective Folks called the San Bernardino district attorney, who directed him to Maury Weiss. Now, Maury was an elder abuse specialist. He quickly established what was clear to Jack's friends from the beginning. The women were taking advantage of him. Within hours of Jack's disappearance, Marcia Johnson had begun looting his estate, and there was actually only $14 left in the account. Now, Dick, we've done a lot of these cases where people have millions or hundreds of thousands of dollars, and then at the end they've got like under $20 in the account.
Yeah.
It never fails to just stun me.
I mean, you have to know that they're going to be looking at that, right?
Yeah. Yeah, but I mean, it's just so ridiculous.
And
I mean,
they're going to say, this is a very suspicious thing. But they keep doing it.
They do. They do. And then they're out of money. So even though they're stealing, killing, you know, whatever they're doing for all this money, they don't have anything to show for it in the end either.
No, because they spend it quicker than they make it.
And they don't earn any more.
Right.
I don't know how many cases I could mention this kind of thing, but I mean, you know.
We've done a few.
You see it a lot, yeah. Now, like Sandy Bailey, Weiss was convinced that Marcia and Judy had killed Jack at this point. I mean, what else? What else could have happened at this point? Jack's not in Seattle.
Nope.
He's not accessing any money anywhere. How would he be living?
And he's not at his cabin or his house.
They've been sold.
He's
They're
gone.
Not even his anymore.
He's
totally
in
gone.
The wind.
Right. So Weiss's goal isn't just to convict these women of elder abuse and financial fraud. He really thinks that they need to put together a murder case, of course. Which is kind of far-fetched, though, at this time, because he has no body, no blood, no proof that Jack's dead, you know, other than what?
Other than a suspicion. I mean, he has no record of Jack being alive, but it's a little bit of a stretch to say he's dead. Anyway.
But where else would he be?
Where else would he be? And you've got all this other stuff going on that would suggest that something happened to Jack.
Well, that's what I mean. They're not being subtle about it at all. It's outrageous.
No, they aren't.
Well, this is a good spot, I think, to tell our listeners about our sponsor today.
Yeah, let's take a break.
Our sponsor today is Hanover Square Press, publisher of The Innocent Wife, the international best-selling novel by Amy Lloyd. This book is right up the alley of us true crime lovers. It tells the story of a young schoolteacher who falls for a man on death row, who she believes has been falsely accused.
Yeah, I'm always fascinated by this scenario. You know, the psychology and motivations of women who fall in love with a convicted killer. I mean, what drives them to this? And we've had plenty of examples, particularly the Menendez brothers.
Yeah, there's actually, I don't know if it's still out, but there used to be a TV show about women who were in love with prisoners or married them.
Yeah, I never could wrap my head around that.
Never fails to fascinate me. So here's just a little taste of the delicious plot. 20 years ago, Dennis Danson was arrested for the murder of Holly Michaels in Florida's Red River County. But now he's become the subject for a new true crime documentary. Filmmakers are building up a movement to uncover the truth about Holly's murder and free Dennis. Our lead character, Samantha, lives in England, but she begins writing letters back and forth with Dennis. The letters become more intimate and she falls in love with him. Samantha leaves everything behind to marry him and work toward his release. But in a final twist, things take a turn, and we start to wonder if Dennis is really guilty after all. What happens if he's freed and turns out to be guilty after all? Maybe even kill again.
Yeah, now this is good stuff.
It really is.
It's perfect for true crime addicts. A really compelling story of obsession, and it's available now. Look for The Innocent Wife wherever books are sold.
And I would imagine that means electronically as well.
I would think.
Yeah, so you can get your Kindle version. So another year went by, and Weiss found a clue about the missing Jack Irwin. Interestingly, it was provided by Marcia Johnson herself.
Yeah. Well, Marcia just loved to talk.
She really did, right?
And she would go on and on and on.
I mean, not to take any of the guilt off of her, but she was crazy.
Yes.
Or is crazy. Yes.
Yes, she is. So that's a diagnostic term.
Crazy.
Crazy.
Yeah.
Okay.
Crazy as a shithouse rat, I think, is the complete diagnosis.
I think so.
So 2 days after the cabin fire, the arson investigator was interviewing Marcia and Judy when Marcia happened to mention that she was suing her psychologist, with whom she claimed to have had a brief affair. The suit was settled for around $30,000. While he was reviewing testimony from the lawsuit, Weiss was stunned to find a reference to Jack Irwin. The psychologist, Deborah Martin, said that Marcia told her she had shot Jack and chopped him up. For Weiss now, this was an enormous break. However, the lack of physical evidence was still leaving him in a bit of a quandary. He felt it might not be enough to get a conviction without the body. But to me, I'm thinking, why didn't the psychologist tell anyone about this if she was told that? I mean, you've got your patient, counselor, confidentiality, but when someone confesses to murder, we've already decided
Right.
That takes a back seat.
It does. But at the same time, Marcia was telling the psychologist that she killed other people too.
Oh, she was?
Yeah.
Okay.
So there was this whole thing about basically Marcia was just blowing smoke.
Yeah.
So I can see that, although...
So she didn't really think it was real.
The psychologist thought it was not a true story.
Okay. Still, might be something you want to look into.
It might be, right?
Right.
And if it wasn't for this guy Weiss pouring through every record he could find, he never would have discovered this.
Yeah, because the file on the disappearance of Jack Irwin was quite thin with the police. It was just 2 or 3 pages. They had the original missing persons report filed by Marcia, and they had a note that police had put a stop on his Social Security direct deposits. So this is a big thing, right?
Yeah.
If he wasn't getting his Social Security deposits anymore, it's unexplainable that he wouldn't be inquiring about them. How is he living?
Right, because he hadn't done anything about his bank accounts or anything, which were tapped out anyway.
Right.
And he hadn't called and said, "Where's my Social Security check?"
No.
So that's suspicious for him not being around.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a very strong indication that he was no longer alive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So September 4th, 2002, Weiss met with San Bernardino County Sheriff's Department Detective Bobby Dean, and they came up with a plan to stir the pot. Their idea was to confront Marcia and Judy basically with one legal problem after another. Search warrants, arrest warrants, Board of Psychology subpoenas, declaring that the remains of the cabin posed a fire hazard. So their idea was if it worked as planned, the women would become so unnerved that they would make incriminating statements to each other. And at the same time, a judge had approved a wiretap on their phones for the next couple of weeks. So hopefully they would say something incriminating and be recorded.
Well, that's what they're hoping for. Because they really feel like they need some kind of confession because they don't have a body.
Yeah. They're basically, as you said, they're not going to get anywhere without a confession.
No, probably not.
No.
So the plan was launched in late September. Weiss made a phone call to Marcia, saying he wanted to stop by her house and drop off some paperwork. The paperwork Weiss gave Marcia was actually an arrest warrant, notifying Marcia, with a second warrant for Judy, that they were being charged with secondary commercial burglary, grand theft by embezzlement, theft from an elder, recklessly causing fire to an inhabited structure, insurance fraud, and grand theft auto. So he said they had 2 weeks to turn themselves in, like this was just some kind of way for them to get a chance to get their things together.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry, but police don't do that.
No.
If police
even back in 15 years ago.
No. If police have enough to arrest you, especially with all these charges, they don't say, "Oh, we're giving you, 2 weeks notice so you can get things together."
Two weeks to figure out what you need to do.
So that just shows a lot of stupidity on their part. I mean, it reminds me of the movie Michael Clayton, when George Clooney is the cleaner, the fixer-upper, and he goes to the guy's house who has been in a hit and run, who has hit somebody, and the phone rings, and the guy says, "Is that the police calling?" And George says, "The police don't call." Right?
Yeah, right.
The police aren't going to give you any warning.
They just show up.
Right. If they're coming to get you, they're coming to get you.
Yeah.
So to me, it just shows that these women are very naive if they think that that's what's going on here.
Right. Well, as you said, they're stirring the pot. So we're setting things up.
They're just getting them all whipped up into a frenzy, really. So they say they have 2 weeks to turn themselves in. There's no mention of a murder charge on the warrant, but this really did have the desired effect, didn't it, of unnerving them?
It sure did. I mean, their daily phone contacts increased dramatically.
Yeah.
But while they talked frequently on the phone, Marcia seemed to want to shoulder most of the blame for their predicament.
Yeah. Now she's like being very protective of Judy.
She is. So the other thing that the investigators did was to execute a search warrant on the women's home. And one of the interesting highlights of that was that they found a lot of the items that had been reportedly lost in the fire still in their possession.
You know, I've looked into this, and this is not that uncommon when people make these false theft claims.
Well,
what they'll do is they'll hide the objects away for a while, and then they'll bring them out and just have them back in their possession.
Yeah.
Stupid.
Stupid, stupid.
Stupid, greedy stuff. I mean, that was definitely worked against them as far as those charges would go. So the final move here by Weiss was to seize their Ford Expedition. Now, this is the vehicle they suspected was used in the transport of Jack's remains after he was murdered.
Right. So Judy's working at her job as a counselor in the prison when police showed up to confiscate the vehicle. So Judy immediately called Marcia, who became very angry and upset, and Marcia called her attorney, a guy named James Brown, and then called Judy back. Brown wants to know why they took it, Marcia asked Judy. And Judy said, well, because Deborah Martin said that you confessed to her that you murdered Jack and that you transported the body in that car.
So the jig is up, man.
Jesus fucking Christ was her response.
Right. So now Marcia's off the rails. And when Marcia goes off the rails,
she crashes in a big way.
It's crazy town.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Marcia finally understood all that had been going on in the past 2 weeks now. If Weiss knew about Deborah Martin, then he did know about her confession to Deborah. And if he had this confession, well, she's basically done for.
She is.
So then Marcia tried to call her mother, but there was no answer. So she called her Aunt Janie. Now, she said to her Aunt Janie, and we've heard this recording of this call. She said, it's all over. Everything's over. I'm turning myself in for killing Jack. They already know. They already know. The really creepy part about this to me is that her aunt didn't sound surprised or shocked at all about this. So I really feel like her aunt knew that she'd killed Jack.
Oh, no question. And her mother.
Yeah. So I'm thinking Marcia, Judy, the mother, the aunt, they all knew. And they all benefited from his money. This is so disgusting and upsetting. I mean, it's always upsetting. You know, it's always more upsetting to me when it's women because I always feel like women are, I don't know. I know it's not true, but I guess I always kind of feel like women are morally superior.
Wait. Where are we going here?
I just have a general feeling like women are less violent, which is true. Men are more often committing these crimes.
That's true.
So I generally feel that way, but obviously here.
Yeah, but you find a bad apple every once in a while.
Quite often, actually, yeah. And I really think I'm too naive about this. My eyes are opening that, of course, women can be just as bad, just like men can be just as good.
Thank you.
Yes. But that doesn't change the fact that I'm stunned that these four women, or four people at all, knew about this.
Well, we don't know for sure that they knew about it. I mean, the evidence strongly suggests that it was common knowledge among the four.
Well, don't you feel pretty sure that Judy had to know, though?
Oh,
yeah. I mean, aunt and mother aside.
I'll
Judy's spending money and driving the Corvette and shit.
Yeah. I'll give the aunt and the mother a little bit of leeway, but not Judy.
It's generous of you. More generous than I am, but... So despite her insistence to her Aunt Janie that she was turning herself in, Marcia didn't do that.
Not that night, anyway.
No.
And...
But she did seem really shocked that so many people knew about what was going on.
Yeah.
Yeah, because she thought that she was getting away with it, I guess.
She did at that point. Now, she didn't turn herself in that night, as you said, and she didn't turn herself in over the course of the next week.
No.
So, I mean, she tells her Aunt Janie she's doing that, and boom. So on October 9th, 2002, Weiss and Dean applied the finishing touch. They went to Marcia and Judy's cute little home in Alpine and arrested Judy as an accessory to murder. Now, this is a big step.
Yeah, and I don't know why they didn't follow through with that. I guess because she testified, but we'll get to that. But I guess Judy was quite stunned by this. It was unexpected, although I'm not sure why.
Well, I mean, from what we hear about earlier conversations, Marcia kept telling Judy that she was bearing the rap on her own.
Well, sure, you can want to do that, but there's evidence that Judy was in on it.
There sure is.
So while they were there, Weiss and Dean told Marcia that they were going to arrest her also for murder, but they weren't taking her in at that time. So I guess they just want to get more on her?
Yeah, so yeah. I think that's another example of kind of rattling her cage.
Yeah. Which right. Her cage rattles easily anyway.
It does. So Judy's bail was set at $500,000, which meant that someone had to come up with $50,000 to pay the bail bondsman. So they talked to their insurance company to rush through a second mortgage. They maxed out their credit cards, and Marcia had $40,000. But the bail bondsman, the big meanie, insisted on the full 10%. So Judy had to stay in jail.
Am I the only one that's just dumbfounded that they couldn't come up with $50,000 after stealing $500,000?
They spent it all.
I know, but it's just dumbfounds me.
I know. It wasn't there. And it didn't say that she sold the Corvette or anything like that.
No, I don't get it. And as far as I know, there wasn't any drug addiction or... So where's the money going? I don't know.
Material world.
Just stupid. So the most frustrating issue for Marcia was that the jail wouldn't accept her calls for Judy. So she had to wait until it was Judy's turn at the payphone so she could call Marcia. On one of their conversations, Judy told Marcia she needed to get out of the house. If Weiss and Dean came to arrest her, no one would be left to bail either of them out, and no one would be able to care for their dogs. So it just cracks me up that they're worried about who's going to care for their dogs.
I mean, what the... Never mind.
I love dogs, but I mean, the dogs are better off with somebody else, let's be honest.
Yes.
Yeah. So Marcia agrees that she's going to take the dogs to her Aunt Janie and leave the house. But Marcia didn't do that. Despite what she told Judy, she quickly decided that she could not leave her dogs behind.
So she drove to El Cajon, a two-hour drive, where she found a hotel that would accommodate both her and her pets.
Now Marcia, though, she's not the type of person who tolerates being alone very well.
Not at all. So she drank half a bottle of vodka, some Bailey's Irish Cream, plus some beer, and then she called her answering machine at home to see if Judy left her a message. Now, if I did that amount of drinking, I wouldn't be capable of making a phone call.
No, me either.
I'd be in a coma.
Yes.
Or
most
at least
people would be.
Deeply asleep.
Well, you wouldn't remember what you did the next day, for sure.
No, you wouldn't. Now, the problem with calling home to check the answer machine was the wiretap was still in effect. So the call was traced back to the hotel she was staying in. And Weiss and Dean headed to El Cajon to pick her up. So these two guys arrived shortly after midnight on October 11th, 2002, which was more than 3 years after Jack Irwin had first gone missing.
A long time.
It is, but they're getting to the end. They parked outside her room and Dean called her cell phone. Marcia, he said, pretending to be an Alpine, we're at your house. How come you're not at home? And she hung up on him. I mean, what does she think is going on?
Well, let's not forget she's drank a half a bottle of vodka and some other alcohol.
Maybe she's not thinking clearly.
I don't think so.
So Weiss and Dean get out of the car, walk up to the door, and they knock. Marcia peeks through the curtains, says, uh-oh, I'm done.
Yeah.
And she let them in.
Yeah. So she's taken in. Now, on the way back to the police station, Marcia repeated that she'd tell them everything. But then she said, you have to remember, Judy didn't do anything wrong. She's still insisting on protecting Judy.
That's right, for whatever reason.
She loves her.
Oh, you think?
Well, as much as she can love anyone.
Okay.
She's obsessed with her, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. So she wasn't defiant anymore, and she even thanked Weiss for bringing an end to the chaos in her life. Once they're back at the station, Marcia waived her Miranda rights and confessed to shooting Jack and dismembering him with a chainsaw. So this is what you hear in our intro as part of that confession.
Right.
Which is outrageous. Any comments on that? Or you want to go through it first?
Let's go through it.
Okay. So she told police that she was going to show them where she had distributed his remains, but then she changed her mind about that. She told Dean that she never planned to hurt Jack, but she just snapped that day. She said that her thought before shooting him was that no motherfucker is going to hurt me again.
And then after she was convicted, in a jailhouse interview, Marcia gave her side of the story. In response to the question, where's Jack Irwin, she said, he's up on the old highway up there, Glendora Ridge Road. So here's Marcia's side of the story. She said there was an unpleasant side to the old man, insisting that he was not so nice to them. She said, Jack was an asshole. He was a feisty little shit. I loved him. But then I got to know who he really was. He was constantly trying to create problems between me and Judy. He didn't like Judy that much, but he really wanted me. Really. Okay.
This is her story.
He bitched about Judy. Bitch, bitch, bitch. I used to tell him, that's my wife, but he continued to do it.
So she's really got this attitude like, this is all his fault, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's really where she's headed.
So the impression is that he's almost like coming on to her.
Yeah. And abusive, and, you know, what else was she to do? Now, one afternoon, she claimed she came home to the house in Upland and found a white powder around the dog's dishes. She said, I asked him what the hell it was, and he told me it was ant poison. The dogs apparently didn't eat the poison or become ill. But Marcia said she was really angry that Jack had tried to kill their dogs.
Well, if that's true, maybe he was just trying to keep ants out of the dogs' food.
And maybe it's all made up.
And that's more likely.
Yep. So Marcia said, I told him after he poisoned my dogs that I was going to kill him. I said, I'm going to kill you, and I did it a couple of weeks later. Now, after the incident with the ant poison, Marcia and Judy moved back up to the cabin, she said, with their dogs. Shortly after the move, she talked to Jack about him coming up to the cabin to help her with some construction work. So I think this was a way to lure him out.
Yeah, we're getting Jack up there.
She picked him up at his house and asked him to use the bathroom. She went inside, grabbed his gun, and then came back out. She said the gun was loaded. She planned to kill him on the way back to the cabin, but she said there was too much traffic, so she decided to wait until they arrived at the cabin. Once there, they began to work. He called me a nasty girl, she said, and it really pissed me off. I've got issues, and when he said that, well, that was the end, I guess.
That sealed his fate.
Yeah.
So Marcia again asked to use the bathroom, and she said the bathroom window is right where he was, so I heard him out there just bitching away. And that's all I needed to get my nerve up. I ran out there and I just shot him. We heard that on the intro.
Yes, yep.
Afterwards, she's looking for something to cover him up with, and she found a chainsaw. And that's when I got the idea of chopping him up, she said. Jeez.
I know. So she got gloves, plastic bags, and a giant Rubbermaid container. And she went about the nasty business of dismembering Jack's body.
Right. And as she said in the intro, cut off his head, his hands, and his feet.
Yeah.
And left the torso with arms and legs.
Right. So she placed the bag, body parts, and the container in her expedition and started driving around. She ended up on Glendora Ridge Road. She took the head out of the bag and rolled it down the mountain. Then she said she drove a few more miles. His torso was in a sleeping bag, and she threw the sleeping bag over the side of a cliff. She was getting ready to take off, and she went, son of a bitch, his wallet's in his pocket.
Yeah, I mean, this is almost comical.
Yeah, yeah. It's outrageous.
So she climbs down, gets his wallet out of his pocket, looks inside, there's 20 bucks in cash, which she keeps, rips up the other contents in the wallet, and put the wallet itself in a dumpster.
So this is a sociopath.
Isn't it?
And she has no empathy whatsoever that this is a human being. It's so scary. It makes my blood just curdle.
I know. So there wasn't any blood on her clothing or any expedition. And she said she remained clean and wore the same clothes to this tire store that she was wearing when she killed Jack and dismembered him.
So this really surprised me, but according to Weiss, there isn't as much blood as you would think in this situation. Because Jack's heart was not pumping, and he'd already lost a lot of blood from the gunshots that killed him. But, I mean, she had to have some microscopic blood on her. She couldn't have been totally clean.
She couldn't have been. There's got to be some spatter.
I would think so. But I guess nothing obvious on her clothing.
Nope, apparently not. So his hands and feet are still in the Rubbermaid container. And Marcia drives into Upland and purchases a new set of tires. This is just astounding to me. I mean, how can you do that?
I don't know.
Car's up on the lift, tires are changed, and the Rubbermaid container with his hands and feet are still in there.
Yeah, I mean, all these tire guys would have to do is take a peek.
Right.
And didn't seem to really faze her. So after that, she headed east on Mount Baldy. She pulled off the side of the road somewhere. She said that his feet were still in his shoes, and she tossed them. Then she went down the road a little further and threw his hands out. Then she turned back around like, no biggie, I guess. She threw out the Rubbermaid container and the sleeping bag in different dumpsters. When she got back to the cabin, she dismantled the entire chainsaw and the gun, putting each piece in different trash containers over several miles. So you can say she was crazy, but she was very logically thinking this all through, that's for sure.
Right, she's disposing.
It was methodical.
Very.
Then she threw the gun over the mountain. Now, once Marcia confessed to the murder, she called Judy a few times from jail. They became estranged, and Judy testified against Marcia eventually at her trial. Judy pled guilty to just one felony charge of receiving stolen property, and was sentenced to 180 days in jail to be served on weekends.
Now, does that gag you as much as me?
That's unbelievable.
Isn't it?
Yeah, really. Unbelievable. I mean, they didn't even really need her to testify to get the conviction is what gets me.
They didn't.
They had the confession.
So investigators, even to this day, believe that Judy is much more involved in the crime.
I do too.
Well, yeah. So Marcia herself was convicted of 26 counts, including murder, arson, and grand theft. And Judy was sentenced to one charge of receiving stolen property.
That's just ridiculous.
Gotta be kidding me. So Marcia's sentenced to life without the possibility of parole, and her appeal has been denied.
Well, Judy could still possibly be tried for murder or accessory to murder if any new evidence were to come out. There is no statute of limitations on murder. I mean, it obviously seems that she was very involved, at least after Jack's murder, if not beforehand. She knew that the money was being used, bought a Corvette, a motorhome, was using Jack's money to live on, basically.
Well, she had to.
And she knew he was gone.
She knows how much money is coming in to this relationship.
And we know Marcia doesn't keep secrets well.
Right.
So we knew that Judy knew. She had to know Jack had been killed. If she wasn't involved, she would have been going to the police with some concerns about his whereabouts and where Marcia was getting this money. But she never did that. She knew what was going on, but I guess the police just didn't think they had the evidence to prove it, which I don't understand. To me, it seems like they did.
Well, yeah, again, retrospectively, it seems like she should be charged.
Yeah, and she still could be.
Well, possibly. We're like 15 years down the road now, right?
Well, it seems unlikely that they will at this point, yeah.
Yeah. The investigator Weiss told the LA Times that Marcia Johnson was one of the coldest, non-remorseful persons he'd ever met. What does that make Judy?
Probably a similar person, I would think.
I would, too.
And she's free.
So after the trial, the Mount Baldy community hosted a dinner for the investigators and prosecutors for all of the work they did for Jack Irwin.
Well, I mean, I hate to be negative here, but they really didn't do a lot for Jack Irwin to protect him in the first place.
They didn't, but they couldn't at the time.
I disagree a little bit.
Well, what would they have done?
I think that the elder abuse guy could have investigated sooner and went and talked to him about these women were getting all this money. Did he really want them involved?
That's still after the fact.
After the fact they got involved, but not while he was still alive, I'm saying.
I don't think so. They didn't really raid his accounts and do all the big spending until after he had disappeared.
All right.
So they...
It's just hard for me to think they did a lot for him when he was killed.
Once he was killed.
Right. They helped solve the case, but it didn't help him. He's gone.
Right.
Right.
But I don't think they could have done anything before his death.
I know.
Has anybody made a complaint against the two women?
Well, I think that maybe... The neighbors did, didn't they? Or did they not say anything till after?
Not till after. Not till he vanished.
Okay, so they couldn't have done anything sooner, but solving his murder, does it really do him any good? That's a philosophical question, which I kind of think no.
No, but they were happy that the prosecution was effective.
Yeah, I mean,
They got a conviction.
On one of them. So they did 50% of their job.
Okay. I'll leave it at that.
Okay.
Now, Jack's former neighbor, Sandy Bailey, keeps a picture of Jack in her sewing room, picture of Jack holding her son. She says, so I get to see him all the time.
Yeah, she seemed pretty heartbroken.
She was. Yeah. She really loved the old guy.
She did. Then more than 10 years ago, she purchased a burial plot for Jack. And it's sitting there just in case his remains are ever found. None of them have been found. She says he's just always in our hearts, and we have a place if they ever find his body where he can be buried. He was very dear to us, and she said that it's something he would want them to do for him. That's what she said to the LA Times reporter.
Yeah, this lady really loved him.
Yeah. Now, most of our research on this case did come from the court records and the articles from Paul Ciotti of the LA Times. And there's also an episode, if you're interested, on this case. It's called Come Back Jack. It's on the show Murder Book on our favorite network, Investigation Discovery. Now, Dick, before we go over feedback, can we take a minute to share some things about our podcasts, our website, and what we've been up to and have in the works here at Tigrebber?
Well, we always do.
Okay.
Of course it's okay.
Well, one thing I want to bring up is our new t-shirts are here, and they should be up for sale on our website soon. Our website, in case you don't know, is www.tiegrabber.com. We don't say much about our Shop the Brewery merch page because selling merchandise is not something that we do to make money. We mainly just like to sell things so that things are out there in the world with our name on it for people to see that we're out there. Also, if you're a fan of the podcast, owning a t-shirt or a glass or whatever can be something you want to do. So check out our new t-shirts or our classic tees. We're going to be selling them both at cost just to make sure that everyone who wants one can get one. If you haven't seen the new designs by our contest winners, check them out. We really love them. They're great. I've been wearing mine quite a bit. Also on our website, you can sign up to have access to our members-only TCB episodes. This is very affordable. You can pay $3 or $5 a month, whatever fits into your budget. We also have about 20 of them in the can now, and new ones being released monthly. So when you sign up, you're going to get a little thank you package too, in case you don't know. If you're a $5 a month subscriber, you'll receive one of our patented True Crime Brewery snifters. These are Dick's go-to glass for most of the beers he reviews on the show.
Yeah, you can't go wrong with a snifter.
No, they are great glasses. I use them for everything. Plus a sticker, some coasters, and maybe even a refrigerator magnet. So it's a fun thing to find in your mailbox or on your doorstep one day. If you contribute the $3 a month, you're also going to get a sticker and a magnet, plus a True Crime Brewery credit card-sized bottle opener, which you can carry everywhere to just open beers on the go, especially That's good right. in the summer for picnics, things like that. Now, if you're looking for another podcast to listen to, check out our podcast, Watching ID, where we watch a show on the Investigation Discovery channel, and we talk about it. Right now, we're covering Season 5 of A Crime to Remember. We appreciate any support you give us, and we value our Tiger River members above all others. Well, except maybe our immediate family members and one or maybe two of our dogs. I'd like to say thank you to everyone who sent us feedback for our show. The quality of the feedback we've been getting is really top-notch, and we've had so much lately to choose from. It's been great. So if you have feedback to share, send it along to us at truecrimebrewery@tiegrabber.com, or you can share it with us on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. Also, remember that support for this podcast is brought to you by The Innocent Wife by Amy Lloyd. The Innocent Wife is a novel that follows the marriage of a school teacher named Samantha to a death row inmate who is the subject of a true crime documentary campaigning for his release. Sam, however, is suddenly not so certain that he is innocent. But how do you confront your husband when you don't want to know the truth? The Innocent Wife is available now. All right, let's do some feedback.
Feedback time. I'm going first today, right?
You are.
So this is from Patricia H. with a case suggestion. Patricia H. says, I'm a huge fan and wonder why you've not done this case. The info, books, YouTube, etc. is ginormous. It might even have to be a 2 or 3-parter. But I find it one of the most fascinating cases of all. Don't you agree? Keep up the good work. And guess which case she references? Jeffrey McDonald.
Okay, I know I've heard of that, but refresh my memory.
Well, this is a famous, infamous case. It's mm-hmm. been covered for 40 years, just about. So, Dr. McDonald is a physician who was convicted of killing his wife and two daughters in 1979. The murders occurred in 1970. And this has been a extremely controversial case.
This is the one that was in People magazine last month.
It's been in People. It's been in everything.
Okay.
This is a case where he and his wife and kids, he's an Army doc on Fort Bragg, and he claims that he awoke one night with intruders in his house, hippies, kill the pigs type of thing.
So this was after the Manson time?
Yes.
Okay.
And he alleges that they stabbed him. He was unconscious for a while. He awoke to find his wife and daughters dead. Now, he was eventually convicted of the crime, and he's been in jail ever since, despite numerous appeals. And there's a lot of stuff about the case that suggests that maybe he didn't do it, and there's a lot of stuff that suggests he did do it. It's an absolutely fascinating case.
So it's something we should do.
It is something we should do.
It hasn't been done to death?
I don't think it's been done to death. It's certainly been done.
Yeah.
And I agree with Patricia H. It'd have to be more than a one-part thing.
We've kind of shied away from that, though. We've been trying to just get things done in one episode.
All right, maybe we could, but let's think about it.
Okay.
There's a book called Fatal Vision by Joe McGinnis that talks about it in depth. McGinnis, I think, was hired or was approached by McDonald to portray him, McDonald, in a favorable light and cast doubts about his guilt. And McGinnis became convinced during the research for the book that McDonald was guilty.
Okay, this is ringing bells.
And that's the whole tenor of the book is that he did it. Oh, yeah. We've discussed it more than one occasion before, okay. But I think it'd be a good thing to do.
Okay, could do it. Sounds good. But like you said, it might have to be a two-parter, so we'll have to do some planning on that.
Well, I think, because there's just so much stuff about it.
Or it could be, you know, it could be for our members-only feed. We could do a two-parter for that and have two episodes in a month. If us are looking for something like that to do.
Yeah, we could do that.
So that's a possibility. So I have a case suggestion from Lisa Kay. She says that we continue to be awesome, and she's learning about beer.
Well, that's our mission.
That's right.
We want you to be awesome, or want us to be awesome, and we want to teach everybody about beer.
All right. Then, according to her, we're succeeding.
Good for her.
So Lisa says she found this article in the Times, and it seemed to be just the kind of case we'd love to do. So just a little bit about it. She gave me a link to it, and it was October 12, 2003. The residents of Argyle Road in Brooklyn were woken by gunfire. Then, as now, such a thing was virtually unheard of. The quiet street is in Prospect Park South, an architectural enclave of 100-year-old trees, landmark homes, and an urban gentry of lawyers, chefs, and jewelry designers. But that morning, as police arrived on Argyle Road, not coincidentally, in minutes, the worst came to pass. The body of a young man was discovered in a driveway, just outside a Queen Anne house, toward the end of the block. He was lying face down on a bloody yellow blanket. In the dawning daylight, it soon became apparent that he had been shot 5 times. 15 years later, the circumstances of how that man, Mark S. Fisher, a 19-year-old college student from New Jersey, wound up dead in the driveway, remain the subject of a simmering debate, in spite of nearly every fact-finding method the criminal justice system has at its disposal. There was a 2-week trial. There were several state appeals. There was a federal appeal. There were countless legal hearings. There was even an exhaustive inquiry by the Brooklyn District Attorney's Office. But all of them have so far failed to silence the suburban whispers. Earlier this month, an appeals court addressed some of those whispers when it abruptly threw out the conviction of a man found guilty of killing Mr. Fisher, ruling that the prosecutors at his trial withheld evidence from his lawyers and relied on testimony from a witness who had lied in sending him to prison. Then another hearing raised more questions than it answered, and prosecutors suddenly announced that they were going to challenge the ruling that threw out the conviction, and they were going to retry the man, John Gusha. Many murder cases are built on science, fingerprints, ballistics, DNA, but Mr. Gusha's case was built from the start on something more tenuous, the shifting stories of a group of privileged young people who were partying with him and Mr. Fisher on the late night into morning when Mr. Fisher died. People lied, changed their statements, and often contradicted one another. This wasn't really a forensic case, said Mark Hale, the prosecutor who oversaw the probe by the district attorney's office. This was a case of who said what to whom when. The murder victim, Mark Fisher, was a sophomore at Fairfield University in Connecticut. Notwithstanding the Fisher family's grief, should the prosecutors, given the evidence they had, gone ahead and tried the case the first time? Though he and his friends were underage, they used fake IDs to bar hop on the Upper East Side. They ultimately landed at Bar Harbor, a pub on First Avenue, popular with the college students.
So somebody gets killed.
Yeah.
Mr. Gusha.
No. Mr. Fisher.
Mr. Fisher.
Yeah.
Mr. Gusha's convicted or charged.
He's the one that goes to trial, yep. So, yes, there's a lot to this that goes on and on. I'm not going to bore everyone by reading it. Just giving you a taste of it, and I'm going to put it in our to-do pile.
Okay.
Okay, you can do the next piece of feedback. Thank you, Lisa.
Okay, this is from Wendy H., another case suggestion. If at any point you're looking for an interesting UK crime to cover, I'd really enjoy listening to a podcast on the murder of Sadie Hartley. Two middle-class women were convicted of a murder, which was plotted over many months, with one of the women writing in her diary about their plans. There's a good documentary about this crime on YouTube, which follows the detectives, who are fascinating in their own right, who worked on the case. So, just a brief synopsis. Sarah Williams, age 35, stunned Sadie Hartley with a cattle prod and stabbed her 41 times in an orgy of violence. She attacked Miss Hartley, who was 60, at her home in Helmshire, Lancashire, in a bid to win back ex-lover Ian Johnston. Williams and her accomplice Katrina Walsh, aged 56, were both found guilty of murder and given life sentences. Jurors at the Preston Crown Court deliberated for 7 hours and 9 minutes before returning a verdict at the end of the 7-week trial. Williams told the jury her relationship with Mr. Johnston had basically broken down in 2014, but she remained obsessed with him. In September that year, she sent an anonymous text to Miss Hartley, boasting that she had had fantastic sex with Mr. Johnston and accusing her of blackmailing him to stay together. So it sounds like a scorned ex-lover. Interesting. That's something that might be fun.
Okay, put that in the pile. I have another case suggestion from Michelle A., and Michelle says, "Good evening. I like the new look of the website. Thanks, Michelle. And I also thought I would mention that it's nice to hear you talk about the regulars at the quiet end. It keeps it real and a nice added touch. I have a case that I thought both of you may want to discuss, and I've added some links and a small synopsis about the case. So here's the synopsis. A friendly, affable high school jock who was raised by a respectable family in northern British Columbia, surrounded by snow-capped peaks, bustling mill towns, and a remote wilderness, Cody grew up hunting for grouse and fishing for trout with his grandfather. He was also a prolific text messenger and social networker who frequented online dating sites under the name One Country Boy. And though he got into occasional bar fights, the 6-foot, 220-pound baby-faced young man seemed to be anything but a troublemaker."
Wait. The occasional bar fight?
Yeah.
And you're not looking for trouble? I mean, how many bar fights have you been in? Or me? Already thinking that somebody who's gotten into a couple bar fights is not the innocent young person that I'm led to believe.
I get what you're saying, but if you just listened, he might have had a minor criminal record, but you certainly wouldn't have expected him to be the youngest teenage serial killer in Canadian history.
Whoa.
So now there you go. Is,
okay.
All right.
I'm listening. You got my attention now.
Okay. So the other thing I like about this from Michelle is that she has a list of the victims' names and little background on each of them. So I think that's very nice. She really put some effort into giving me this information. She, you know, parsed out what I needed to know so I don't get super lengthy like sometimes I can. And she gave me all the pertinent information. She also took the time to Google some craft beer companies in Prince George, British Columbia.
Okay.
So
I love her already.
Yep. So she's got those for you. So thank you, Michelle. This is definitely something I'm interested in doing this. So it's the Country Boy Killer.
Okay. We'll put that on the hot list.
That's on the fast track to Breweryville.
Right.
Okay.
Stardom.
That's right.
Okay, I'm going to do a couple comments, and they're both on the same case, the final act.
Okay, so that's the Daniel Wozniak killed Julie and Samuel.
Kibuishi and Hare. So Fat Loser says, "This is such a senseless..." What?
It's just a terrible YouTube name this person
Well,
has.
That's what Fat Loser says.
I know.
"Such a senseless, horrific crime. I mean, Kibuishi was essentially murdered to be a prop." Well, yeah.
That's just disgusting.
Hare was going to go down as a rapist and murderer, forever tarnishing his honorable legacy in the military.
Yep, it's true.
And for what? So this creep Wozniak could pay for his wedding with his stage slut.
Oh, well, I don't know if we need to call her that, but she did seem to know more than she said.
She did.
I'm not a fan of her.
So if you like that one, you like this one. Wozniak should get life in prison and put in a cell for 24 hours a day with 2 6-foot-5, 300-pound butt rapists.
Wow. I don't have any comments on that.
Okay. We'll leave that one.
Okay.
All right. Same case. This is from Tom W. "How did Wozniak plan on getting all that money? If you can only get $400 with each withdrawal from a person who police think is a dangerous person on the run."
Right.
"Didn't he know that the police would have the account frozen?"
Doesn't make any sense, does it?
No, but you know, you don't think clearly. You're thinking just point A to point B. I need X amount of money for my wedding and honeymoon. This guy has my money. I'm going to kill him and take his money.
But even a stupid, heartless person should have at least thought to write a check from him to himself or to something. You know, the $400 visits aren't going to do it.
No.
And the account's not going to remain open endlessly.
It's not. That's true. And your teenage accomplice is going to get tired or
Yeah.
Or get caught ordering pizza or something.
And that was just a huge waste of two young lives.
It is. Just a
scumbag.
Totally senseless.
Yeah, totally senseless. Okay, I have one comment, and it is from Andy Arn. It's about the Robert Fisher case. Hi, I'm a regular listener, and I heard you mention Robert Fisher. I went to Southwest Baptist Bible College with him in 1982-1983. He was the most misogynistic man I've ever met. He was very close with my former youth pastor, Ken Hodgson. Ken started his own cultish church that preached complete patriarchy and submission of all females. He was on America's Most Wanted talking about Robert's disappearance. I truly believe that if Robert didn't kill himself in the forest, that Ken helped him get away. I understand there have been sightings of Robert in Central America, and coincidentally, Ken has set up missions in Central America. I don't know if he's alive or not. Just knowing him for the few years I did, he has haunted me since then. So I thought that was a really interesting comment from Andy.
Oh, absolutely. I think that gives a whole bunch of possible information.
Yeah.
I mean, because I've been convinced that he died, that he's not alive anymore. But this would indicate that maybe he is living somewhere in South America.
Yeah, I mean, I can't help but think that Ken would have been thoroughly investigated, though.
Well, yeah, but still.
But still, it's interesting. And I just thought this was a members-only podcast, so a lot of our listeners might not have heard it. But if you do want to hear it,
there's a way to do it.
There
you
is.
You can join up.
You can join up, and then you could hear that podcast. But anyway, thank you, Andy. That's really interesting, because I certainly got the impression that he was misogynistic, for sure.
Oh, no question.
And it sounded like his wife didn't want to put up with it anymore.
Well, that she was tired of his bullshit.
Yeah, exactly.
So what better thing to do than murder your wife and children?
Right.
And stage your disappearance.
Yeah.
Although I'm still thinking that he's dead, but that's an interesting comment.
It is.
Thank you.
It's an interesting aspect we didn't know about.
So I have a case suggestion from Mimi, a story that she thinks we should tell.
Okay.
It's called the Bluebell, which is a 60-foot sailing vessel that was the site of five brutal murders on November 12, 1961.
Well, that's an older one.
It is. And we've had another suggestion about this one. It's an interesting case. The ship was chartered by Dr. Philip Dupereau of Wisconsin for a trip from Fort Lauderdale, Florida to the Bahamas. And accompanying him with his wife, Jean, and his three children, Brian, Terry Joe, and Renee. The ship was skippered by a World War II veteran, Julian Harvey, and accompanied by his sixth wife, Mary Dean. So, and it turns out that Harvey allegedly killed the wife, the doctor and his wife, and two of the children. One child managed to escape by feigning death and got picked up. But the whole thing was that he was planning on killing his sixth wife, and he was seen or caught in the act by the doctor. So he had to kill all of them as witnesses.
Wow, that's an interesting one.
Good way to think, huh?
No.
So that's a pretty good story.
Yeah, have there been any movies or books about that? Or
yeah, I have a couple books. One looks pretty good. So I think that was one I was picking out anyway as a good case to do.
Oh, okay.
This might be something fun. So let's put it in there.
Okay.
All right.
Do you have anything else?
No, just our daughter's Department of Motor Vehicle stuff.
I wondered what those papers were. All right, well, thanks everyone for listening today, and we will see you next time. At the quiet end.
We'll be there with beer. Goodbye.
Bye-bye, everybody.